Moncrief on News Talk.
Brought to you by Avant Money. Think you're getting the best value from your bank? Think again.
Now, your dentist will always tell you that you should do your best to get rid of the plaque in your teeth. But for archaeologists, the hope is that people in the past didn't heed such advice, because plaque is literally a fossil in your mouth. Professor Christina Werner is an archaeogeneticist at the Max Planck Institute in Germany and joins us now on News Talk. Good afternoon, Christina.
Good afternoon.
As I understand it, the plaque in your mouth can fossilize. How quickly can it do that?
Actually, very quickly. You're constantly forming it, and then it will periodically mineralize. It's a little bit different in each person how frequently that happens, but once it begins, it can calcify within 2 weeks, and then the process starts over again. And actually, because it does it over and over, it builds up like rings of a tree or layers of an onion on the surface of your teeth.
Right. Okay. So if you're studying someone from 20 or 30,000 years ago, it's a time map as well there at the plaque on their teeth.
That's right. I mean, it actually, you know, has spatial dimensions. So the layers that are closest to the surface of the teeth formed earlier in their life, and the ones furthest away formed latest. You have this kind of ordered record of the life they lived.
Right. So give us an idea of what kinds of things plaque can trap within it.
It's a little bit amazing and scary just how many things it can trap. Really, almost anything that enters your mouth can become entrapped. It is very sticky. The vast majority of it is actually made up of your oral bacteria, and they're what actually make the plaque, and they secrete the kind of sticky substances that you feel on the surface of your teeth. But we find all sorts of other things entrapped in calculus. Some of your own DNA, for example. We find little microscopic bits of food, things like starch granules or something called phytolith, which is a type of plant glass. We find pollen, often seasonal pollen that people are breathing in that might even be, you know, because giving them allergies. We also find occupational debris, things like microcharcoal from smoke they may have inhaled, and in some cases even pigments from painting.
Right. Okay. Now, and as I understand it as well, the kind of microbiome in your mouth, there's bacteria that lives there that hasn't really been studied that much, or some of it doesn't even have a name yet.
Yeah, this was really interesting. So we conducted a study to try to understand how our oral microbiome has changed and evolved through time, and how it's changed with us. And we looked at a number of different primates and tried to look at how it had changed. What we found is that actually it's remarkably stable over long periods of time, and there are a few groups, about 10 groups of bacteria that are really consistent all the way from howler monkeys to humans. We share them. They seem to be kind of core to the primate oral microbiome. And they turn out to perform really key functions in the mouth, but they're very understudied. So the vast majority of dental microbiology work has been done on bacteria that are known to be associated with disease, but very little work's been done on the bacteria that are associated with health. And that is something that I think became really clear with our study, is that many of these members that seem to be the most important, that have evolved us the longer, that probably play critical roles, are so understudied that many of them haven't even been named yet.
That's extraordinary that they haven't been named yet. Now, you did mention starch there. And as I understand it, starch, or at least the existence of starch in the human microbiomes or Homo sapiens microbiomes, might give an explanation as to why we have bigger brains than some of our cousins.
Yes, this is a fascinating question. And this was a discovery we made that we kind of stumbled upon. We weren't looking for it. But one of the things we know that characterizes humans is our very large brains. And at the same times that our brains get bigger, our gastrointestinal tracts get smaller. And so we know that this process of becoming human must have been associated with a new type of diet that was more energy dense. But we don't know what that diet was. There's been a lot of ideas, and many people have proposed that hunting and meat consumption may have been part of that. And certainly early humans did hunt. However, there's also been a lot of growing evidence that starch consumption and targeting of starches, things like roots and tubers and bulbs, might have also played an important role. But starch is very hard to find archaeologically. It doesn't preserve as well as, for example, animal bones. And so, you know, the hunt for starch in the archaeological record, especially in deep time, has been really difficult. What we found, which was so surprising to us, is when we actually compared the different bacteria across primates, we found that humans are very unusual and that we have a very large number of bacteria that belong to one group, and this is the sanguineous group of Streptococcus. In fact, chimpanzees almost have none of it at all, and yet it's the most abundant type of bacteria in our saliva and in our dental plaque and really in our mouth today. What makes it different from all the other bacteria in the mouth is that it's evolved this kind of unique ability to steal the enzymes from our saliva that we use to digest starch in order to digest starch for itself. So it kind of has this monopoly among bacteria in accessing our dietary starch. And it's done this by literally stealing the enzymes straight out of our saliva. And so we found this, and we found this in all the humans we studied, but what was interesting is that we also found it in Neanderthals. And that seems to suggest that part of the reason these bacteria raised to such high frequency in humans is because we were consuming starch. And by extension, then Neanderthals were likely consuming starch. And because we find the same form in Neanderthals and humans, we can infer that it was present in their common ancestor. And now we're pushing back starch consumption to around 600,000 years ago on the African continent. So we're starting to think that starch may have actually played a pretty important role in early human evolution. And I'm just so excited that we found evidence for this in a place we would have never thought to look intentionally through the evolution of the bacteria in our mouths.
And is this only a recent development that people have started looking at, particularly the calculus, that's the other term for the plaque, but and what it contains?
Yeah, it's very new. I mean, people have been commenting on it for a long time. And even as early as the 1930s and 40s, archaeologists would mention that they noticed it. But for a long time, people in museums and other places would simply scrape it off so they could see the teeth better. It really wasn't until the late 1970s that it was noticed that sometimes these plant microfossils preserve. And it was only in the 2010s that the first molecular approaches were used to try to understand it. I know when I first worked on it, no one had ever published on any kind of genetic studies of it before. And in fact, the only published review article suggested that there probably wouldn't be any. Everybody I talked to said, work on something that's safer, less risky. It's probably not going to work. But I was really interested in it and kept pursuing it. And we found out actually it's incredibly rich in ancient DNA. In fact, it's the richest known source of ancient DNA in the entire archaeological record. It's really amazing. And it was right under our noses that whole time, but we just didn't study it until very recently. We also didn't quite have the tools to study it. Really, since 2010, there's been a revolution in biomolecular technologies that has really opened the doors for us to be able to ask these questions.
How far back can you go with this? So far, or in other words, what's the oldest example of plaque you've been able to study?
So the oldest that we have been able to study and really recover an intact, authentic oral microbiome from the lifetime of that individual is about 100,000 years old. And that's from the Pasteurina Neanderthal. We would like to try earlier, and we're going to try earlier. The oldest ancient DNA ever recovered from any type of sample is about 1.1 million years ago and comes from mammoth bones. But I'm hopeful that we can push back the dates on calculus as well.
Right. Okay. And can we go back even? We could theoretically go back even further.
Well, it's thought that the limits right now using the current ancient DNA technology that we have is probably around 1.1 million years, maybe a little bit longer. And that just has to do with DNA slowly breaks down, basically breaks into pieces. I tell my students, I call it the world's worst jigsaw puzzle because it just is, it's literally as if you took a genome and then broke it into a million pieces and tried to put it back together again. At a certain point, the DNA becomes so short that you can no longer tell which piece fits together. And so that cutoff point happens at about a million years ago.
Still, it's absolutely fascinating, the amount of information we can extract from things that are so tiny. Christina, thank you so much for speaking with us today. That was Professor Christina Warner, an archaeogeneticist at the Max Planck Institute for the Science of Human History in Germany. You are listening to The Moncrief Show on News Talk. We're going to take a break. After that, freezing human eggs.
Moncrief on News Talk.
Brought to you by Avant Money. Think you're getting the best value from your bank? Think again.